Have you ever really stopped to think about the pilgrims? You know, those iconic figures from American history. How did they actually get to Cape Cod, Massachusetts? I mean, we often hear about where they landed, but maybe not so much the why or what it really took for them to make that incredible journey. Today, we're not just tracing a voyage on a map, we're doing a deep dive into a massive migration, looking at these powerful forces that, well, both pushed people away from everything they knew and pulled them toward a completely unknown future.
Yeah. And to really get a handle on any big human migration like this, we need to talk about something called push and pull factors. It's a key concept. So push factors are basically the bad stuff, the conditions or problems forcing people out of a place. Think maybe religious persecution, serious political trouble, or just grinding economic hardship.
Okay, things making you want to leave. Got it.
Exactly. And then pull factors are the opposite. They're the appealing things drawing people to a new place. Maybe it's the promise of work, a chance for a better life, or the freedom to believe what you want. Now, you often have both happening, but usually you need a really strong push to make someone take such a huge, costly, and frankly, terrifying step into the unknown. It's that tipping point, you know?
The calculation of risk versus hope. It makes sense. So our mission today is to look at the pilgrim story through exactly that lens. We want to unpack the intense pressures pushing them out of Europe and the sort of daring hopes pulling them towards North America. And then stick with us because we're going to ask you to think about a similar kind of journey, maybe one that's still way off in our future. All right, let's start with the push. What forces were driving the pilgrims out of their original homeland, England?
Okay, so the Pilgrims, or as they initially were, English separatists, were a pretty radical religious group back then. Their beliefs just didn't line up with the official Church of England. It's important to remember they were even more radical than the Puritans. Puritans mostly wanted to reform the church from within. These separatists, they thought it was beyond saving. They wanted out completely, to worship their own way.
Which would have been seen as problematic, to say the least, by the crown.
Oh, hugely problematic. An insult to the king, who was head of the church. After decades of religious turmoil since the Reformation, they felt things hadn't changed nearly enough. Queen Elizabeth hadn't budged on reforms they wanted. Then King James I comes along in 1603, and any hope they had vanished. He famously threatened to harry you out of the land, basically, drive them out if they didn't conform.
Wow, harsh words.
Extremely. Openly disagreeing was bordering on treason. People faced persecution, even torture or execution. So for William Bradford and his group in Scrooby, leaving England started to look like the only real choice they had left.
So, pushed out of England by persecution. But America wasn't their first stop, was it? There's an interesting middle chapter in Holland.
That's right, yeah. Around 1608, many of them, including Bradford, moved to the Dutch city of Leiden. Holland at the time was, well, remarkably liberal and tolerant compared to elsewhere in Europe. They welcomed people who were willing to work hard and follow the rules. Bradford actually wrote a lot about their time there in his book of Plymouth Plantation.
And their ideas were still pretty radical, even in tolerant Holland.
Definitely. Their minister, John Robinson, taught about a kind of democracy within their church decisions made by the consent of the major part. That idea, even just within a church, was seen as a potential threat to the established order back in England, church and crown.
Okay, so they found some freedom in Leiden, but it clearly wasn't the final answer. What started pushing them out of the Netherlands?
Right, it wasn't paradise forever. While they had, as Bradford put it, much peace and liberty for their religion, other problems cropped up. Big ones. First, economic hardship really set in. These people were mostly farmers back in England. In Leiden, they ended up in the textile industry, working incredibly long hours for very little pay, living in poverty.
That sounds grim.
It was. Bradford records some saying they prefer prisons in England rather than this liberty in Holland with these afflictions. That's pretty telling. On top of that, the local autonomy took a hit, the wool market collapsed, and politically, things were getting tense. The 30 Years' War was raging in Europe, and a truce between Spain and the Dutch was ending. Their peace felt fragile.
So economic stress and political instability.
Yes, but there was something else, maybe even more worrying for them. They started fearing the Dutch culture itself. It was more secular, more liberal, and they worried it was corrupting their children. They saw their kids being drawn away by evil examples, losing their English identity and drifting from the church's ways. They desperately wanted their children to stay English, but they couldn't go back to England because of the religious situation.
Stuck between a rock and a hard place, essentially. England's out, Holland's not working long term. So their eyes turn westward across the Atlantic. What was the pull towards North America?
Well, North America offered several powerful pulls. First and foremost, it was the promise of a completely blank slate, a new home where they could build a society based entirely on their beliefs. They could raise their children according to their own faith, their own philosophies, and crucially, keep that English identity they valued so much.
So religious and cultural freedom, primarily.
That was huge, yes. But there was also a significant economic pull. They hoped for greater stability, maybe land ownership, things they couldn't achieve in Leiden. And there was a religious mission component, too, they spoke of, propagating and advancing the gospel among the Native Americans. Though, it has to be said, they also joined what was basically a business venture.
A business venture? How so?
They got a patent, a land grant from the Virginia Company of London to settle near the Hudson River, what's now New York. And London investors, the merchant adventurers, put up the money for the voyage. They weren't doing it out of charity. They expected a return on investment from things like furs, timber, fish.
Okay. So the pilgrims weren't just refugees. They were also signing up for an economic enterprise.
Exactly. They were religious migrants, absolutely, but also economic migrants. It was this complex mix, religious conviction, economic need, and this desire to preserve their culture that finally pushed them toward that incredibly risky Atlantic crossing.
Right. And even with all that motivation, the journey itself, yeah, it sounds like it was almost doomed from the start.
It was incredibly perilous, and they were frankly ill-prepared. Their first attempt involved two ships, the Speedwell and the Mayflower. But the Speedwell just kept leaking. They had to turn back multiple times. Imagine the frustration, the cost. Many families just gave up at that point.
But Bradford and the core group pressed on.
They did. Utter determination. So eventually, 102 passengers crammed onto the Mayflower, which was really just a rented cargo ship. And it wasn't just their group, the Saints, as they called themselves. There were others, the Strangers, who were more like adventurers seeking fortune, not sharing the same deep religious convictions. They all set sail in September 1620.
Which was late in the season, wasn't it?
Terribly late. That meant hitting the North Atlantic during peak storm season. The voyage took 65 days, and it was just brutal. Bradford called it a big leap into the unknown. Imagine being packed into the tween decks, dark, damp, stinking steerage. Constant seasickness. People were facing death every single day. The physical and psychological strain must have been immense.
And didn't the ship itself nearly break apart?
It did. About halfway across, a massive storm hit, and a huge crack appeared in the main structural beam supporting the mast. Even the experienced sailors were terrified. But incredibly, they managed a makeshift repair using a large iron screw, something they had brought along for building houses once they landed. Pure luck, really, that they had it.
Just surviving the crossing sounds like a miracle. And their health must have been deteriorating.
Absolutely. The diet was awful, mostly salted meat, hard biscuits. Lack of vitamin C meant scurvy was a constant threat. Too much salt, no fresh food, no exercise. They got weaker and weaker. The crew wasn't always sympathetic either. Bradford mentions one sailor who constantly cursed the seasick passengers, wishing they'd die and be thrown overboard. Though, ironically, he was one of the first to die on the voyage. Yet, amidst all that misery, a baby, Oceanus Hopkins, was born at sea, a small sign of life continuing.
And then, after all that, they didn't even land where they were supposed to.
Nope. Those storms blew them hundreds of miles off course. They completely missed the Hudson River Valley. On November 9th, 1620, after those long 65 days, they finally spotted land. But it was Cape Cod, way north of their patent's jurisdiction. The captain tried to sail south towards the Hudson, but the waters were too dangerous, full of reefs and shoals. They had no choice but to turn back and anchor there, at the tip of Cape Cod.
Okay, so they land in the wrong place, outside the area where their investors and the English government gave them permission to settle. What happens now? Does authority just break down?
That was the real danger. Because they were outside the Virginia Company's territory, some of the Strangers started saying essentially, hey, the contract's void. We're not where we agreed to be. We can do whatever we want when we get ashore.
Chaos waiting to happen.
Exactly. The Pilgrim leaders realized they needed some kind of agreement, some way to maintain order and unity fast, before anyone even set foot permanently on land. So right there in the cabin of the Mayflower, they drafted and signed the Mayflower Compact.
The Mayflower Compact. We hear that term a lot. What exactly was it?
It was really a foundational document. You could call it a very early, maybe primitive form of democracy or self-government. Some see it as the first constitution in American history, in a sense. It basically established that they would create their own government, enact just and equal laws for the general good of the colony, and crucially, that they all promised to obey those laws. Decisions would be made by the consent of the major part.
And this was signed by both the saints and the strangers?
Yes, most of the adult men signed it. It was critical. It wasn't a declaration of independence, but it established self-governance based on majority rule because their official charter didn't apply where they landed. It held the group together through that incredibly difficult first winter and really laid the groundwork for their colony's government for decades.
So they have an agreement, a framework for governing themselves, but they're still standing on a cold, unfamiliar shore in December. Winter is setting in. The reality must have been terrifying.
Utterly terrifying. On December 21st, 1620, the first landing party rowed ashore at what would become Plymouth. Bradford wrote, "They fell on our knees and gave praise to God." But the conditions were horrendous. The Mayflower, where many still lived while shelters were built, became a hotbed of fever. They'd arrived too late to plant crops. No shelter, little food, brutal cold.
And the death toll.
It was catastrophic. That first winter, about half 50% of the 102 passengers who arrived died. Fever, probably pneumonia or consumption, dysentery, scurvy from the lack of vitamins. It just swept through them. And added to that physical misery was constant fear. Fear of the unknown wilderness and fear of the native inhabitants. All they knew about them was basically horror stories from Europe propaganda depicting them as savages or cannibals.
How did they even cope with that level of loss and fear?
It's hard to fathom. Bradford describes how, at the worst point, only 6 or 7 people were well enough to care for all the sick and dying. They even propped up sick or exhausted men with muskets on guard duty, trying to look stronger than they were, terrified the Native Americans would see their weakness. Yet, remarkably, not one person chose to go back on the Mayflower when it sailed for England in the spring. That shows this incredible, almost fanatical commitment to their ultimate goal, this idea of building their own society no matter the cost.
So how did this desperately weakened group manage to survive that first year?
Well, exploring parties found signs of previous Native American settlement, abandoned villages, burial grounds, and crucially, stores of corn, seed corn. They basically took it. They called it a special providence of God. They left a note saying they intended to pay for it later, though history suggests they never actually did. That corn was vital.
Then they actually encountered the local people.
Yes. The first real encounter wasn't until March 1621. A lone Native American man walked boldly into their settlement and greeted them in English. His name was Samoset. He'd learned some English from fishermen who'd been coming to the coast for years. It must have been astonishing for the pilgrims. Samoset later came back with the local leader, the Wampanoag sachem, Massasoit, and another man named Squanto.
Squanto, another name many people recognize. He was an interpreter.
He was, and his story is incredible. He was a Patuxet Wampanoag who had actually been kidnapped years earlier, taken to England, learned English, somehow made his way back, only to find his entire village wiped out by European diseases. He had his own complex motivations and ambitions.
So this meeting, Samoset, Massasoit, Squanto, this becomes key to Plymouth's survival. What was the dynamic there?
It was complex and, you could say, politically expedient for both sides at that moment. The Wampanoag, including Massasoit's people, had been devastated by diseases likely brought by earlier European contact. Their numbers were severely reduced. Massasoit seems to have seen these newcomers, the English, with their powerful weapons, what they called really cool high-tech stuff, like steel axes and muskets as potential allies, maybe a good buffer against their enemies, other rival Native American groups.
And the pilgrims obviously needed help. Desperately.
Desperately. Squanto played a crucial role as interpreter and, well, negotiator. He knew English culture and language. He apparently even played on their fears,
yeah.
Supposedly telling Massasoit the English kept the plague stored in barrels and could unleash it if they wanted. This led to an alliance, a peace treaty between Massasoit and the pilgrims. It was definitely an uneasy peace in many ways, but Massasoit honored it for his entire lifetime, which was crucial. It gave Plymouth the security it needed to establish itself.
And the Wampanoag taught them how to survive in this new environment.
Absolutely vital. They taught them how to cultivate native crops, especially corn. Their European seeds mostly failed in the New England soil. How to fish, hunt, basically how to live with the rhythms of the land. Without that Wampanoag knowledge and that initial peace treaty, it's very unlikely Plymouth colony would have survived.
So William Bradford, the man who'd been orphaned, led his congregation out of England. Then Holland survived the Mayflower, became governor, and with the help of the Wampanoag, the colony starts to find its feet. Beyond just surviving, what kind of society did they build? What were their lasting impacts?
Well, they did establish some precedents. In spring 1621, they held the first civil marriage in the colony. This might sound minor, but it was a deliberate move to separate civil duties from church duties, which would have huge consequences down the line in American thought. And importantly, voting rights, suffrage, wasn't tied to church membership initially, unlike the later Massachusetts Bay Colony. It emphasized equal treatment under their civil laws.
And the first Thanksgiving.
Right, that famous event in the fall of 1621. It was essentially a three-day harvest festival. The Pilgrims had a successful harvest, thanks largely to the Wampanoag's help. Massasoit and about 90 of his men joined them. They brought 5 deer as a contribution. It seems to have been a genuine moment of celebrating their survival and reaffirming that alliance.
Though it's important to remember how that relationship changed later and how that event is viewed now.
Extremely important. While that first Thanksgiving might represent a moment of cooperation, many Native Americans today view it very differently. Some see it as a day of national mourning, marking the beginning of colonization, displacement, and violence. Because later on, especially after Bradford and Massasoit died, the relationship deteriorated into conflict like King Philip's War. The English did deny Native Americans their freedom, deported many as slaves. So the story is far more complex and tragic than just the peaceful harvest feast image. And Plymouth Colony itself, always a bit of a struggling enterprise, was eventually absorbed by the much larger, more powerful Massachusetts Bay Colony to the north in 1691.
It's such an intense story. Radical self-determination, incredible endurance, building a new society from scratch. Driven by those push and pull factors we talked about, they definitely laid down some early markers for American democracy, but the reality, like you said, was complex, and for the Native Americans, ultimately tragic.
It really does make you think, doesn't it? Try to put yourself in their place. Facing those choices in England or Holland, getting on that tiny storm-tossed ship, surviving that first winter, how would you have felt? What would it take to make you do that?
It's almost impossible to truly imagine. So let's pivot from the 17th century Atlantic to, well, maybe the 21st or 22nd century red planet. Let's think about settling Mars.
Okay. A different kind of pioneering, but maybe the same fundamental human drivers are involved.
Exactly. Using that push-pull framework again. What could be the push factors that might convince you, our listener, to leave Earth someday? Is it climate change making Earth less habitable? Running out of critical resources, maybe political turmoil, or just a desire for a completely new start, a different kind of society.
And what about the pull factors drawing people to Mars? The sheer adventure, the chance for groundbreaking scientific discovery, the opportunity to build a brand new society, maybe learn from Earth's mistakes, or is it just that ultimate frontier calling, that need to explore?
Could you handle that journey? Months, maybe years, in a confined spacecraft? Could you land on a hostile world and figure out how to survive? How to solve the inevitable problems that would crop up trying to build a colony on Mars?
And what kind of rules would you make? What kind of compact would you draft for a new world, trying to balance freedom with the absolute necessity of survival?
It's a fascinating thought experiment, isn't it? And it connects us right back to the Pilgrims 4 centuries ago. It highlights that enduring human quest for a new beginning, that willingness to face the unknown no matter how daunting the journey looks.